Hey folks, it's John. Welcome back to another season of Talk to Me in the Car, a podcast about all things teaching related and education inspired that I literally record right here in my vehicle on my drive back from work as a high school instructional coach just outside of Washington, D.C. This week's podcast will be a little bit more serious maybe than some others. Certainly, I want to bring energy, enthusiasm, and life and excitement into our classroom, but I also want to bring safety and support to all of our learners, regardless of their color or creed or their background. And unfortunately, in this day and age, politics seems to be making an increasing appearance in our classroom spaces. That's not to say that we are more political today than we've ever been, but it seems like the right thing to do as a teacher to talk about some really hard stuff. And so this week's episode will deal a little bit with questions of American politics and how to handle it in our classrooms, particularly in light of the events at the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. last week. If this doesn't seem like your cup of tea before we even get into it, you might want to just skip this week's episode. New episodes drop every Monday. Feel free to like or subscribe on your favorite podcasting app or leave a rating. It helps other people find the podcast. Or you can hit me up on Twitter at @mehanedu, and I will gladly hang out with you and talk about this or any other topic that makes sense in your teaching space. As an instructional coach, a big part of my job, as I say over and over again, I'm not actually teaching content. I'm teaching people, and I'm working with people and listening to people, a lot of listening to people, to see where trends are and see where problems arise and see where pain points exist so we can help teachers navigate out of those difficult places. Because the truth is, we're all making this up as we go. We're all building this plane as we fly it, and you don't have to go it alone. There are some fantastic resources out there and some best tips and best strategies to kind of keep in mind. So I wrote a book called Adrenaline Rush. It's all about game-changing student engagement inspired by theme parks, mud runs, and escape rooms. And there's a website for it. It's www.edadrenalinerush.com. That's adrenaline with an E, like educational adrenaline. Has all the templates and resources and things from the book, social media. Feel free to plug and play, use and steal any of that stuff. And let's find a way to help your classroom, help the students directly who are going through whatever they're going through. Try to move at the speed of life. Because they're going through all sorts of crazy stuff. And I would be remiss in a public platform if I did not talk about the craziness that was last week and last Wednesday's events at the Capitol building. I'm going to talk about it by way of a very elaborate metaphor. You know the story. You've seen the images. You've probably followed the social media in horror and lost or unfriended a million people on Facebook because they've continued to talk about it in a way that doesn't jive with the way that you see it. And it feels like we're living in two Americas. We're living in this divided America that how can this even be? How can this side think these things? How can they feel these things? How can they see what I see and not believe what I believe? There's all these comparisons to Orwellian politics or this idea of this fascist takeover or this, deep state conspiracy. And it can be really challenging. I try to keep my conversations as apolitical as I possibly can. But at a certain point, if it walks and quacks and looks like a duck, I just got to say, hey, man, that's a duck. But let me tell a story instead of getting into the politics as we see it, just to tell maybe some sort of way to bring some clarity and some closure to some of this stuff, at least from my education perspective. I'm going to take you back when I was a kid. I played Little League sports, rec league, not like the stuff that you had to pay for too much because we didn't have that kind of money for the traveling sports. We were never on like the great baseball teams or the traveling soccer, but like Saturday soccer, right? Saturday baseball. You'd have practice like once or twice a week, one or two nights a week. You swing the bat a little bit. A coach who's probably somebody else's dad would tell you how to choke up on the bat and swing the whatever it was. Where they'd run you around the soccer field a few times, let you kick the ball around, do some dribbling drills, game of sharks and minnows. And then every Saturday you get together and like the blue team would play the red team would play the yellow team would play the green team. And eventually, at the end of the season, everyone would get participation trophies, but there would be the trophies for the winning team that were a little bit bigger. Let's say they got first place. Make no mistake, I think we all knew back then that participation trophies were a joke. And if you don't believe us, see that box that I left at mom and dad's house when I moved out and I never planned on coming back and getting? Yep. Every one of those participation trophies right in there, covered in dust, sitting in the attic. No desire to celebrate myself for a participation trophy. But we did understand the idea of winning and losing, even when it hurt to understand it. As kids, it hurt so much to find yourself on the side when the clock ran out that said that you had fewer points or you had fewer runs and you were down in the box score. I remember playing from the era of T-ball up, that every game we would play, we lived in a small town of Bethlehem Township. There were like four or five club level teams that we would play with. So like maybe 20 or 30 kids spread out over the course of three or four teams, right? And then we partner with the nearby township, Union Township, because they were a little bit larger than us, or they dealt with the same kind of things we did. And they'd bring their three or four teams to us. So if there were four teams from Bethlehem or four teams from Union, in the end, you'd have like eight teams you can play. And so you get your schedule at the beginning of the year. And this is all before social media, right? So you've got a printed schedule that says at 10 a.m. on Saturday, you play the green team. You play the Strikers. You play the Ball Hawks. You play the Falcons, whatever it was. And you're excited but nervous because all you can do is, you know, follow the rules of the game, right? We know how to practice. We know how to show up for game time. We wear our uniforms. We do our best. But sometimes you just get crushed because you're playing teams from other townships and you had no idea the level of talent that you were going to be up against. And some years it was not good. Some weeks it was not good. The wrong kid gets sick from school that week and he's out for Saturday's game and that's it. Or the wrong student is on a family vacation with her family down in Florida and she has to miss and suddenly you lose your best defender or your best striker and just like that, your team is behind when that Saturday game comes to play. But regardless, win or lose or draw, whether I played Union Township or Bethlehem Township, I showed up with my uniform, I supported my team, my red team and my blue team, and as it ended, when the final whistle sounded, the final out was tallied in the baseball games, the coaches would have us line up on the sidelines, make sure we were all in uniform, and then with a nod would march us out to the other team where their coach would be waiting, and they'd meet us about halfway, either in the midfield or on the center diamond, the baseball, the pitcher's mound, and we'd shake hands, go down the line, and give high fives to everyone on the other team, win or lose or draw. That was so weird as a kid. It made me so angry and so upset because it was so procedural. If you've ever been to a Christian church service, when people just pray but aren't even meaning it, or it doesn't sound like they're meaning it because they're just going through the motions, or in a classroom when students say the Pledge of Allegiance, they sound like zombies, right? I pledge allegiance, pause, to the flag, pause, of the United States. And, like, that's not how people talk. If you said it as a sentence, you wouldn't say that way. You'd be like, oh, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America. But we don't do that. Instead, we just wrote memorization, Our Father who art in heaven, and it just feels soulless. It feels like inauthentic. It feels cheap. And if you really meant those words when you said them, you would bring life and vitality to them. And as you kind of go through the motions, it almost feels like sacrilege to say them in such a perfunctory, going through the motions manner. And I never forget that sound of students saying, you know, good game and congratulations to one another, because it was exactly that same tone of voice. Down the line, all the winners were like, hey man, good game, good game, good game. Nice job, congratulations, nice work guys, good job, good job, good job. Maybe a little bit of smarm, a little bit of sarcasm in there, because most games weren't good games. Often they were blowouts. Hey, good game, man, better luck next time, yeah. But like, it taught you how to be, quote, a gracious winner, when really what you were doing is gloating. And there was a level of that. There was even some of those students here who would do it with a smile, and you could feel the daggers as they were leaning into you and saying good game in such an over-the-top way, so as to remind you just how lowly and how poorly you had played. But then the other side of things was that rote, kind of going through the motions, zombie sound. And students, to the man on that defeated team, would always go, good game, good game, good game, good game, good game, good game. And you can just feel their hearts breaking as they were forced to have their noses rubbed in their loss, as they kind of walked down the line and had the opponents, you know, gloating and gleefully giving them high fives. Now, there was even rumors as kids, though I don't know that I ever saw it myself. I'm convinced if you asked any kid who played middle league or little league sports that, yep, it happened. It happens all the time, that students on the winning team would spit on their hands so they can come on by. And when they said good game, they would rub their spitty hands all over you. Ew. Just to remind you how poorly you had played and how much better they were. You can see the tone of, you know, derision in my voice there, but I think that's the point, is these conspiracy theories would come up, even as kids. Oh man, they're rubbing it in. I just saw that kid spit on his hand. And there were, I mean, there are kids who, good game, good game, good game, good game. They get far enough away from the coach and they'd say, we won, we won, we won, we won. And then we would run and tittle-tattle on them. Ooh, blue team said we won instead of good game. Which one? Number 16 over there with the glasses. And, you know, that's the moment where that's more of a reflection on the person who is gloating than the person who is defeated. But my coaches would tell me, win, lose, or draw, like, hey, you stand up, you shake hands, you high five. You may not be happy with this outcome. You may not agree with the way that it was achieved, but you must accept it. And that's a very powerful lesson that we have as educators to instill in our students of any age. There's a difference between agreement which is, I support this thing. I endorse it. I vote for it. And acceptance, which is, well, I didn't want this to happen, but I recognize empirical reality has unfolded before me in the way that it has, and there is nothing I can do in this moment except to accept. In my own therapy, in my own life, in mental health counseling, and I told that story at length and through the summer and well before it, I spent 4 or 5 years going to counseling pretty much every week, walking through things that I needed to accept in my life. I didn't have to agree with them. Some really awful things have happened to me and to many other people in the whole wide world. I mean, you don't get out of this planet without skin in your knees. It's just part of the deal of being human. You don't have to like that it happened, but you certainly have to recognize that it's part of your story. And in those moments where we would get beat in these games, there'd be all these moments where these kids would say, oh, but that last call was a BS call. You know, the refs cheated, or like they were playing dirty, or whatever it was. Like our coaches would say, I mean, barring the rarest of circumstances, guys, it doesn't matter how we got here. We're here. It's over. Let's shake hands, call it a day, figure out what we can do better next time. Carry yourself with dignity, especially in how you lose. And I think this for us as young men and women, as players, as athletes, was why we do rec sports. It's why we do Little League. It's not about anything going pro. I mean, none of us ever had a shot at any of that stuff. Though you couldn't convince us that because we were quite good in our brains. I scored 2 goals today, 2 whole goals. It was 20-16. Like, a lot of people scored goals. But on that day, man, like, I was convinced that I had learned more about myself as a person than I had as any potential future athlete ever could. It wasn't about whether or not I would play for the Major League Soccer, which wasn't even a thing when I was a kid, or Major League Baseball, which I had no shot at. Like, it was, did I reflect myself and my family proudly? When I came back, could I be proud of the colors that I wore and the way that I wore them? Even if the other team was full of liars and cheaters and kids who spit on their hands and rub it in, how did I conduct myself in that loss? And I think with all of this, talking about the blue team versus the red team, it's not lost on me that we now find ourselves in a situation where we have a divided political environment where some, not all, some members of one team or another appear to be gloating, spitting on their hands, rubbing it in, where students or players on the other team, not all, again, but some, are defiantly stomping their feet and taking their ball and going home. Or worse, inflicting acts of violence on the very field of play or the players who oppose them because they see them not as opponents, but they see them as enemies. And that's a real problem. I do not know how to get out of this mess for our country, but I do know for my classroom that this story is very powerful and it stays with me. My parents told me as a kid that playing the game was part of the fun. It wasn't about winning and losing. It was about playing the game. We had signed up. Those were the rules. I didn't always win. I think I came out on the winning side more often than not. But I learned early in life not to define myself based on whether or not our team was victorious. And I think the challenge right now, and you know, to be very pointed about it, to be very candid, is that there is one particular subset of a political party at this time who has been, I guess, I'll say stoked up, but there's probably meaner or stronger words I could use, who has been led to believe that the only way to determine success is through strength, and winning and losing is the very definition of one's character. To be seen as a loser is like the ultimate failure. And so to flip the script and to change the narrative, to paint oneself as a victim, I didn't lose, the referees cheated, the game was unfair, then you reframe it so that you are always a winner. And I think as educators, we need to be powerfully aware of this dynamic as it's playing out. And I'm sure for many of us, this is obvious, and you've probably seen a million think pieces on it in every psychological journal and, you know, pop culture, you know, the news piece that you can. But when a child feels that they are being threatened, no learning can transpire, right? If that Maslow stuff isn't taken care of, that hierarchy of needs, they can't get there. They can't learn any new stuff. And as we're fighting with our colleagues or fighting with our family members or fighting on social media or fighting with our news outlets, we are doing a lot of that spitting on our hands and rubbing it into the other side. And when they feel threatened, when they feel cornered, they attack. I'm not saying that all of them attack. I'm saying the psychology follows that someone who is feeling threatened and someone who is feeling made to feel like the loser or the bad guy rarely goes through life believing that they are, in fact, the bad guy. Have you ever watched Die Hard? Hans Gruber, the ultimate bad guy, bank robber, terrorist, right? Through the whole thing, he believes himself to be the good guy. He believes the laws about international banking are unfair. And so he does what he does because he feels justified and vindicated in stealing money from the Nakatomi Plaza, up to and including killing people. And if you watch the videos back of what happened on Wednesday, if people cloak themselves in the stars and stripes, they genuinely believe that they are doing something on behalf of that cause. And this idea of enclosed cognition, the science behind we believe we are who we say we are because we wear the outfit of that same group, right? When you dress up like a doctor, you find yourself feeling smarter. When you wear a suit to work, you find yourself feeling more successful. When you sit around in your PJs and take a Zoom call, you feel kind of lazy. You feel like a fraud. When you're wearing only the top half is like the blazer and the bottom half is the, you know, the Crocs, you feel like, I wonder if this is even real. What is this work job anyways? There's this enclosed cognition. We put on the uniform of a team. We believe ourselves to be a member of that team. And we take on this cause that is greater than ourselves, which is, it's not about my loss. It's about this team that I represent and the very values on which this team has been founded. Fair play, right? Sportsmanship, learning from the rules of this game that we've all agreed to and making sure that they are exercised fairly. And so the challenge is, as educators, how do we have that conversation with our students and with our staff and with our colleagues and our friends and our loved ones? Because unfortunately, there is this power dynamic that is going on in many homes and classrooms. And when people feel attacked, they tend to shut down, they tend to lash out. And unfortunately, I do believe this incident at the Capitol will not remain an isolated incident. I believe that sort of thing will continue to happen. So as classroom educators, recognizing that power dynamic, that story of good games and winners and losers, and what it means to be a good sport, can be a powerful metaphor to carry forward into our work every day. That doesn't mean that I have all the answers, but giving space and time for students to reflect on what they've seen and to talk about other times where they may have felt heard or unheard or trampled on, that is not to give space or time to, quote, good people on both sides when one side is storming and destroying at all. Rather, it's to give your students a chance to process their emotions in language that is age-appropriate that they could understand. Many of us, from a very early age, remember that first time we felt a sense of injustice. And if in our classrooms we can speak to that sense of injustice, we have a better shot of flipping its script. I was struck by Ibram Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. He talks about when he was in college, he was working to rally a bunch of lobbyists to march on Washington. And he was very upset with the gradualists around him. He felt that they were not moving big enough and loud enough for the cause. He was like, we have to load the buses with protesters. We have to come down to the city. We have to fight. And he said, in the end, he was very unsuccessful in mobilizing people. And he felt indignant because he was the guy who was fighting for his team the hardest. But he said through age and through time, he has learned that just because you're fighting really, really hard doesn't mean you're fighting really, really smart. And he said, what people who are successful in being anti-racists do is they don't get high and mighty when someone else doesn't share their opinion and then shout them down about all the reasons why they're wrong. If anything, that only galvanizes the opposition. And what winds up happening is we end up in a more divided space in the end. If you are truly radical, you have to lead with that vulnerability and give space for, hey, guys, this is hard. Recognizing some of these counter-arguments here may be rooted in a perceived slight or a perceived injustice is fair. It doesn't mean that there is an injustice, but it's perceived, right? Agreeing and accepting. But here we are, and this is not okay. And we can't stay here. And it doesn't belong where we are, and it shouldn't be where we go in the future. So anyways, I hope you guys are safe. I hope that you're staying healthy. This is not a time that many of us looked forward to. In the next 2 weeks, I do imagine it will get only harder for many of us in our classrooms. Please continue to have these conversations. Please reach out to me on Twitter, how I can help. And stay safe, stay healthy, stay home, wear a mask, and better days ahead. Thanks again. God bless. See you next time.